Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we interview one of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
We have makers, great at making beef jerky, great at making jam, great at making bourbon. Not so good at putting that in a box and getting it to a customer.
Right.
Not so good at building a website and taking orders.
This week, our guest is Craig Kanarek, the founder of Mouth.com, the really cool online indie food marketplace. Mouth sells the best small producer foods from across America. Before founding Mouth.com in 1995, Craig co-founded Razorfish, where he helped create everything from books to films to websites for Fortune 500 companies. He also did an externship on the line at one of Mario Batali's first restaurants, Babbo, in New York City. Here to talk about selling truly artisanal food online, what he learned working for Mario Batali, and how the hell he went from advising Samsung, IBM, and Apple to selling the best peanut butter and jelly is one of the web world's original comeback stories, Craig Kanarek. Welcome to Special Sauce, Craig.
Well, thank you for having me.
I should say that I had so little faith in Mouth.com that when Craig and I had breakfast with Maxwell from Apartment Therapy, Maxwell Gillingham, you said, hey, we should figure out a way that we could do this together. And we were like, I don't know if we see it. So that just shows you what a terrible prognosticator I am. And I'm so glad you've forgiven me, Craig, and you've agreed to come on Special Sauce.
I'm glad you brought the story up so I didn't have to, really.
So first, tell us about life at the Kanarek family table growing up.
So I grew up in a sort of middle-class, upper-middle-class suburb of Minneapolis. And
which one?
In Golden Valley.
Golden. I love Midwestern suburb names. Golden Valley.
It felt like it, except for it was really should have been Snowy Valley, I think.
Right.
About half the year was covered in snow. It was a very, in some ways, it was almost a prototypical sitcom-like experience. My dad had a job at a big company called Honeywell. He would go to work every day with his briefcase from 9 to 5. And he would come home every night and we would sit around the dinner table, my parents and my sister, my younger sister and I, and we would have, it was very regular, you know, we would have dinner every night at 6 o'clock. We put the news on and watch the evening news while we would eat and talk about the news and talk about the food. And my mom cooked most nights. And, you know, we had a big vegetable garden in the backyard. So my mom and I gardened a lot and we, you know, harvested a bit of home produce. I remember always having way too much zucchini, making zucchini bread and having to give it away to people.
Everyone in any garden has too much zucchini. There's a rule.
One zucchini is enough?
One zucchini is enough because everyone ends up dropping zucchinis off at all of their friends' houses.
I guess in the 70s, we didn't quite have that developed. But my mom was a bit of a culinary explorer. She would she watched as much cooking television as she could, which was not a lot because she really was a very active housewife and mother driving us around carpooling things and always starting up little businesses of her own. But she didn't really have a specific cuisine that she wanted to make. And I remember my mom always wanting to try new things. And so she would buy a Chinese cookbook and try to work her way through the book.
Right, like maybe one of the Time Life books could be.
And a Middle Eastern book or get recipes from the grocery store for interesting recipes. And, you know, of course, displaced New York Jews, we would go out for Chinese food on Sundays.
Of course.
But the rest
I
of
went
the week,
to China Jade. We had the dinner for five, even though there were six of us.
Yeah, the problem was in Minneapolis, the Chinese food was not really the same as it is out here in New York back then. But, you know, so it was always an adventure. We always would come home to something really great and delicious and different. And for the first probably 12, 13 years of my life, the four of us had dinner together every night of the week.
Wow. But so she sounds like a bit of a culinary adventurer, which you gravitated to. Like you were happy to participate in her experiments?
Absolutely. I loved it. I think that you know, I loved growing up in Minneapolis, but there was something about the rest of the world that I was also really interested in. My parents were from New York. We used to come to New York and visit their parents a few times a year. And I was always sort of awestruck by how much variety there was here. And just, I mean, look, a kid from the Midwest comes to New York City and your mouth, your jaw drops, you know, and your eyes are wide open. It's like, holy shit, what is all this stuff?
Golden Valley was not a Golden Valley of restaurants.
No, or just of diversity in general.
Yeah.
You know, it was a white, middle-class, suburban neighborhood.
Yeah.
And with a lot of houses that sort of look the same as well, you know. And so
they were truly little boxes on the hillside?
They were. And we, you know, so for me, I think I was just, I was always wanting to see more and try more.
Got it. So did your mother's water really break while she was watching Julia Child on television? Or is that an apocryphal story?
No, that's really the truth. It was an incredibly snowy night. It was a massive blizzard. In fact, I just turned 50 last week, and my mother was telling me that the week before I was born, she was in either two or three car accidents, small little fender benders,
right,
just because the roads were super icy and
always,
you know, always in 6-foot snow drifts. And it was just a crazy week. And that just added a little bit more to the whole story. So, yeah, you know, something must have sunk in at the time.
Literally.
Yeah.
So were you fiddling around with computers at an early age?
I was. And again, I have to probably give credit to my mother, even though I'm sure my parents were both involved. When I was in sixth grade, my parents signed me up for a summer school class. And I remember I took two classes that summer. One was in calligraphy. So one was just sort of this art, old, ye olde craft position of, you know, a fountain pen and lettering. And the other was computers, which in 1979 was not very much of anything. And, you know, we actually, Minnesota was a really interesting place from that perspective. In fact, I had probably been exposed to giant teletype like computers in schools in second or third grade, which back then was crazy. You know, a 100 baud modem and paper tapes and literally like clink machines that would vibrate the room. And so when my parents signed me up for the summer school class, they were told they were the first, it was the first school in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, to get computers.
That's funny.
And then they used them to try to teach. And this was a TRS-80. It was 1980 probably. So it was a TRS-80. It was the first generation Apple II. You know, the teachers had no idea what to do with them.
Right.
You know, they're three pages ahead in some book sort of trying to figure out what to teach kids. And I thought they were fascinating. So, yeah, I was exposed to it at a young age. I didn't necessarily gravitate to it. I a bunch of my friends and I, we all, like three or four of us, had Apple computers in high school, Apple IIs, frankly, to play games.
Right.
That was it. It was
sure.
Sort of a advanced Pong system. And, you know, I had one in my room, but it wasn't the thing that I spent all of my time doing whatsoever.
So how did you come to co-found Razorfish, which became this really, really big deal, and which, as far as I can tell, involved you telling old school companies how to get into the latter part of the 20th century, how the role technology could play in their companies?
Well, that was it. I think, you know, it started out of both, you know, I'd like to say it was grand vision, but it was probably equal parts vision and desperation. So I had.
I think that's what all entrepreneurial ventures
are. Well, I think
it
is. I didn't have a job, right? So I couldn't get a job. So I just started something. I mean, really, that's the real genesis of that. And to be frank, for Mouth and a few other things that I've done in my life, came from that combination of things. Came from not having a job, and realizing my time was running out,
and having ideas,
and having some ideas, and thinking, well, no one else is going to do this for me, so I'm going to go do it. And I, you know, that sent, I don't know if that came from my mom buying cookbooks and just trying things, or my dad being sort of a pioneer in some of the things that he did, even though he was in a very traditional sort of post-World War II work track. You know, they encouraged me to try different things and try wacky things, and so I was encouraged to experiment. Although, to be fair, my parents were also scared shitless that I wasn't going to amount to anything. So,
of course.
They still are. So they're still, you know, what are you going to do? How are you going to make money? How is that going to turn, you know, into something useful? But, what happened for me is that I had gone to graduate school at MIT and had studied this mixture of design and engineering. at
the, was that the innovation lab?
It was at the Media Lab, the MIT Media Lab. I was about 5-6 years old when I was there.
I didn't realize that you went there, because that's, you know, a lot of really famous technologists went there.
Yeah, it was a fantastic program, and I was very lucky to study under one of the most fascinating minds ever, a woman named Muriel Cooper, who ingrained in us a sense of how aesthetics, how design, traditional design, should apply to the
technology.
New world of technology.
Yeah, interesting.
And so, you know, that point of view helped inform what I did after graduate school. But really, also, I got a graduate school with this degree in stuff that nobody could use. I mean, really, it was like, wow.
It was worse than a master's in art history?
Well, you know, I had a bachelor's degree in philosophy and had that problem and went out and got an engineering job. And here I was, you know, a few years later, graduating from Media Lab with a master's degree in visual studies. And no practical skills whatsoever. I could do a lot of programming, could make beautiful graphics things, but not anything that anybody needed. And I bounced around. I slept on people's couches. I bounced around for a couple of years, got an apartment in New York, started working for a couple of companies here doing, you know, helping them out with silly little things. I worked at an art gallery for a little while, helping them try to figure out if they could take their file cabinet full of index cards.
You were an unemployed actor in search of a role.
It really was. And so what happened to me is I thought that I smelled a revolution coming. I saw, and maybe it was ingrained in me, that computers were going to impact everything. That, you know, and one of our phrases at Razorfish was, everything that can be digital will be. And what we meant by that was that digital technology is going to find a way to creep its way into every nook and cranny of people's lives.
It's so interesting that you did that in, I guess, the early 90s.
Well, this was 94. I left the Media Lab in 93, kicked around for 2 years. You know, 94, here in New York City, trying to figure out what to do and just realizing that, you know, computers were going to go from being the domain of nerds and companies into people's lives. And it sounds so crazy to think about what our lives were like then, but you know, the only computer people probably interacted with in 1994 was an ATM machine. You know, very few people had home computers or were doing these things, and you know, still dial-up modems, even cable TV was sort of new.
Right.
So you know, I thought two things. I thought, this is coming down the road. This is a revolution. This is a evolution of society, that we are going to have technology in everything we do. And it's going to be massive, and people don't see it.
And they're scared by it. And you were someone, you and your partner were people with ideas for how they could integrate technology into their lives. And they were desperate, right? Because they didn't have anybody working at the companies.
That's right. And the other piece of it was not just that they were, that we wanted to help them because they were scared. We also wanted to help the entire thing, the entire sort of movement, be aesthetically pleasing. We really, we just wanted craftspeople and people with a sense of design and art and other aspects of life to get involved, because it was the domain of engineers. So the fear was, you know, if we leave this to the engineers, we're going to be living in Microsoft Windows world. And we don't. We want to live in Apple world. So,
right.
So it's our responsibility to sort of, I'm going to use these things. I want to make them as user-friendly as possible. And so it was a mix, and you're right. I mean, look, not only were the companies, did they not have people there and had to find some consultants to help them, we cultivated that, right? There were people who were running around saying, if you don't hire us, you're fucked,
right?
You will be Barnes & Noble. Amazon's going to put you out of business.
Right.
You know, you name a company, Amazon's going to put you out of business. Now, there were the other people who said, Amazon is crazy. No one's going to buy. Why would anybody buy a book
online
from a website?
Right.
And obviously, you know, and then people said, why would anybody buy shoes on a website?
Right.
And we see what's happened since. So
you started with the two of you, but you ended up building a company with thousands of employees.
We
right?
did. It was a crazy ride. We started in our respective living rooms. part time. You know, Jeff in Avenue C in on the Lower East Side, and me in Chelsea, and we went from two people. We went and got an office. You know, typical startup stories. We had we made friends with everybody on the hall in the building that we were that we moved into. A couple of other startups, and when we had important clients come, we would ask them to come down the hall and
so you would look...
sit in our office so we would look busier. You know, people would come in and knock on the door and be like, "I finished that thing," and it's like, "Oh, I'm in a meeting. Please come back later." and it just it took off. It really did, and we were there at the beginning, and there was a small group of us, as you know, because you watched it. It grew faster than anybody thought it was going to, including us.
Right.
You know, thousands of people was never my goal, was never my expectation. I thought we would have a small creative agency of maybe, you know, 40, 50 people. And if we were lucky, we would have five people in London or L.A. so that we could have an excuse to, you know, to fly places.
Right. And then you took it public?
We grew the company. We acquired some companies. We at one point we had around 2,300 employees in
so insane
in 9 countries.
Wow!
I spent 1 year. I spent traveling around from office to office, and I did the math. I looked at my calendar, and I spent more nights on the road than I did in my own apartment.
Wow!
And which you know is not as glamorous as it sounds.
Sure.
At all.
Yeah.
But yeah, we took it public and we wrote it up. And by the way, we also wrote it down. So, you know, at one point we were 2,300 people in 9 countries. 6 months, 8 months later, we were half that size.
Yeah.
Having laid off a whole
right.
lot of people. In fact, I just looked. It was about 14 or 15 years ago to the week where we did our first massive layoff. We laid off 400 people in
wow.
1 day. Which was 20% of our
that's
staff.
So crazy. Yeah, you came to symbolize rags to riches to rags story of the first iteration of the internet. You were like a band whose first album went multi-platinum.
Absolutely. We were incredibly lucky, even though we took our time to step back and look at each other and say, what the hell is going on? We have been rewarded so much more than we deserve because we're just two schmoes from the Midwest who started a company. Some of the realities that most people face, we didn't have to face at the beginning. It was, you know, for us, our problems were how do we grow fast enough?
Yes.
We just can't hire enough people. People are pouring in. Not only that, it's easy to hire people. They're lined up around the corner trying to get in, which was really the case. I mean, we had people applying for jobs left and right, so we never had to go look for great people.
Right.
They came in. We had clients coming in left and right. So
right.
for the
like
first
not,
few
and
years.
And not small clients, not Joe's Dry Cleaners. It was IBM
no,
and
it was,
Samsung.
It was
and...
Ford and Schwab and, I mean, massive companies. And here I am sitting in boardrooms and, you know, with people with the kind of gray hair I have now and looking at me saying, help us. You're right. What are we going to do?
So it's been an insane ride up and down the elevator. And you guys leave Razorfish. How did you make your way to Mouth?
Well, so there were a couple of stops in between. So the first one is immediately after leaving Razorfish, I was fortunate enough to have bumped into Mario Batali at a party. We had been friends much earlier and had not probably seen each other for 3 or 4 years. And I told him I was leaving Razorfish, and that I was applying to cooking school. There was the French Culinary Institute was directly across the street from Razorfish, and I used to look out the window at these guys in their toques, honestly taking cigarette breaks from whatever soup or, you know, souffle they were making, and thinking that looks so much better than this hell that I'm going through at Razorfish. I just want to take a cigarette break from making soup. That's what I want to be doing. And so I said to Mario, I'm going to cooking school. How do I get ahead? What do I do? What's the secret? What do I need to know? And he said, fuck that. Don't go to cooking school. Just come work for me for free. And I thought, well, that sounds like a great deal. So
And the fancy word for that in the cooking world is externship.
Exactly. So so I came in and actually was in I was in the prep kitchen for the first maybe 6 or 7 months of that externship. It was incredible. I mean, I loved it. I did a couple of nights on the line, you know, trailing people, but most of the time was in the prep kitchen. And It was this fantastic, wonderful experience. I was working with my hands. It was making great food. You know,
in a way, it was the polar opposite of Razorfish.
Yeah, I went from digital experiences where I never knew who was looking at them or what was going on,
and everything was in the realm of the hypothetical.
Right, and here I am cutting muscles. I'm working with knives and fire and blood and. You know, and even being on the line was even more, or being there during service was even more fascinating, because the whole idea that you were making this thing that was going out in front of someone, 3 minutes later, they were experiencing it. And then you were getting feedback 10 minutes later with either an empty plate or a not empty plate.
Right.
Was something I couldn't fathom, right? And you had one chance, right? You had to
sure.
get it right. And I remember being there, and the first time, you know, even a dish was sent back for being too salty. And the whole room was dejected for 5 seconds. You know, it was this teamwork attitude, as hyper-competitive as it was. Anyhow, it was great. And there was one crucial moment. I was working at Bob O during 9/11, not in the morning of, but was supposed to go in that day. And no one came in that day, of course, because of what happened. But Mari opened the restaurant on 9/12. And in fact, 9/11 is my wife's birthday, and we had had dinner reservations to go there on 9/11, which we didn't do, but I came into work, which was surreal in and of itself, of going through checkpoints with a knife bag.
Yes, because it was south of 14th
right?
Street.
Most of the team was there, and we knew there wasn't going to be a lot of people coming to dinner, so we started making meals for the rescue workers, for the first responders. So we started making meals for firemen, and you know, it felt really good that we were doing something. We had something to do. But I remember hearing people in the kitchen badmouth Mario and Joe Bastianich, his partner at the restaurant, and talking about what a greedy asshole he was to be open today, that he just wanted to make money. He was trying to just open the restaurant so that he could, you know, he could make more money. He's not even in here with us. He's not even that good of a cook. And maybe he was at one point, but he's not anymore. And I bet he doesn't even make any money today because no one's going to show up. And I remember my first thought was, okay, you just contradicted yourself. He's being greedy. But he's not going to make any money. He's stupid. And then I realized these guys were just talking shit about the boss. And I had just gone through a year of getting anonymous emails about how horrible I was, being sued by stockholders for, you know, trying to screw them over with our stock price, all of these things. It's weird to say that in some ways, emotionally, September 12th, 2001 was one of the best days of my life, because I realized in the working world, part of what people do is they just talk shit about the boss. It's their job.
It's true.
It's not personal. The stuff they were saying about him was not personal.
I can never get used to that at Serious Eats when people talk shit about me. It's still hard to get used to.
It's very difficult because you're trying really hard for these people. But anyhow, it was this moment. So Bob O has this special, you know, meaning for me, even as a non-food person, just as a entrepreneur.
Sure.
To toughen my skin in a way that was really great. And I felt like this weight lifted off of me. So I left Bob O after a couple more months. They offered me a full-time position. So
and
I knew
you
it was time to leave.
That was a path to poverty.
That was a path to poverty to, you know, I had just gotten married. My wife would have been a very short marriage had I, you know, started coming home at 3 a.m. smelling like fried fish. Left that and about a year later ended up at an amazing architecture firm here in New York called Rockwell Group.
Yeah, and I know David Rockwell, who's a famous restaurant architect and now set designer. And
that's right. And so we, David and I and a few other people, had talked about building a new studio within his domain to do non-architecture work, just sort of general creative design. And we got very lucky there as well. And the new incoming CEO of Coca-Cola decided to hire to do innovation. I'm making air quotes. It was innovation. I just need your creativity applied to Coca-Cola. And we started a small studio there to do some innovation, which grew into something much larger. But I got another perspective of the food world. So, you know, at this point, I started working for massive food companies.
Right. And David was the architect of the original Nobu and many, many other famous restaurants. And, of course, now he's a Tony-winning set designer.
And a lot of different types of restaurants. And really the idea of hospitality, right, was the big chunk of this. So hotels, restaurants, being hospitable, you know, the same things that happen in the restaurant, you know, that make great restaurants, he tried to apply to all of his work. But what I got a chance to do is sit in the boardroom at Coca-Cola and talk to executives from Burger King, McDonald's, and Waffle House, and Subway, and,
wow,
you know, all these different, and Kroger. We were talking about Kroger earlier.
Right.
Supermarket chains, Japanese supermarket chains. We redesigned Coke machines. So we did all of these really fascinating things in the world of big food. Did that for a number of years and then left. And that's sort of where our story picked up, where it was sort of around 2010, and I was, this is turning out to be a long story.
Yeah, it's all right.
I was helping a friend teach a technology startup school.
Right.
Taking people who wanted to start companies and taking them through this 12-week sort of program where they learned from other entrepreneurs about how to start companies, how to deal with the legal, how to deal with the people, how to deal with naming and branding and positioning. So there was a sequence of tiny events. One of my students wanted to start an online wine store. And I actually went to Mario and Joe, and because they had a wine store,
yes,
here in New York.
Italian wine merchants.
And I said, what do you think of this idea? And they said, that's a crap idea. It'll never work, and here's why. And they told me, and they were right. And they said, and we have an idea that we want to do. We want to talk to you. And we talked about an idea for a little bit, and we decided it wasn't going to work. And then I started talking to you and Maxwell about how content companies on the internet needed a way to make money other than advertising and subscriptions, and that commerce may be a way to do it. And how could we start stores, right, with blogs and other,
yeah,
content sites to make money? And you guys were great and super fascinated, and you were in the middle of some business things, and Maxwell was in the middle of some things. And so it went very slowly, but knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur, knew I wanted to start something, saw another revolution coming. So in the same way that I did with Razorfish, what I saw in 2010 was the world of food was going through an upheaval. And first of all, the main thing about it was that food was becoming a real interest, personal interest of the public. So it was the launch of the Cooking Channel. It was Top Chef. I think Gordon Ramsay had 50% of the Fox programming. It was, you know, he was on. So there was cooking shows everywhere. There were new magazines in food coming out. There was the rise of celebrity, the second wave of celebrity chefs. So after Mario and Emeril and that first group,
yeah,
you started to see food everywhere. Even Michelle Obama, you know, the
sure,
first lady getting involved in food as one of her primary things that she did when she got in the White House. And at the same time, what was happening here in New York was the sort of revival of, or I don't even know revival is the right word, the sort of, was smorgasbord. It was really for me.
Yeah.
It was this defining moment was going to smorgasbord, and for people who don't know this, it was an outgrowth of a flea market. So some people in Brooklyn started something called the Brooklyn Flea. It was really a traditional flea market, people selling,
right,
their crafts and their old clothes and street signs and ephemera. And the people who ran the flea knew that they needed some food there because if people were going to shop all day long, they brought in some food. The food became so popular, these, you know, the restaurants coming in.
That it was spun off. Yeah, yeah. And it's so interesting because, you know, I wrote a book in 1992 called New York Eats, which was a guide to non-restaurant food.
You nailed it. And that was what was happening culturally.
And Mouth is another manifestation of that. You know, you call it an indie food website because they used to be indie record labels.
That's exactly it. We didn't like, artisanal sounded too snooty.
Right.
And they weren't artisans. And that word was being abused. You know, small batch, local,
yes,
craft, handmade,
yes,
all of that.
Fortune 500 companies are now putting artisanal in their ads.
Exactly. And I used to joke around that back in 2011, you had just as good of a chance getting laid if you were in a bar and you told people that you made beef jerky than if you were told people you were in a band. Right? It was like a cool, like, you do what? You know, and there were guys, they looked the same. It was those, you know, it was hipsters.
Right.
Look, it was, It makes me cringe. You see, my shoulders are up here.
I think it was the tattoos.
Ears. It was the tattoos and the piercings and the beards. But it was the same thing. And so for us, we saw that coming. And we saw it happening. I don't know if we saw it coming, but we saw it happening here. And we knew it was going to happen everywhere else. People were spending their Saturday afternoons in outdoor food courts or at green markets or hunting down a food truck somewhere.
Right, or at chili cook-offs or whatever it was.
And so what we said was, I went out and went out. I was talking to some friends and ended up getting a couple of partners to start this thing. And we said, look, here's what's going on. Of course, e-commerce is massive, so that's one piece. But indie food is a thing, or we're going to make it a thing. And in particular, there was one part of the food world that was sort of being ignored. So restaurants and restaurateurs, they had had their moment and were continuing to have media, infrastructure, that the world knew about them. There was a little bit of talk around farmers, around, you know, celebrity farmers were going to be next. But what I wanted to do was respect the craft of the people who made products. And as you know, I know from being in a restaurant how hard it is to make a plate of good food. I think what people didn't realize is that it's just as hard to make a jar of great pickles and make that consistently over and over and over again and make it at scale, and that you can get as much pleasure out of opening that jar of pickles and serving it to your friends or having it at home. That makes part of a great meal.
Yeah.
And it makes part of a great party, and it makes part of great life.
Because there's a story behind that food.
And there's work. There's so much work and love that was put into those products. And so... We wanted to create, really what we wanted to do was create the next specialty food store. You know, I saw stores here in New York, Dina DeLuca, Citarella, you know, incredible mom and pop cheese shops, specialty food stores, but they weren't paying attention to what was coming next. You know, for them, Mediterranean food, right, gourmet food was still the be all end all. And they weren't on the ground seeing all this great new independent stuff that was coming out right here in their own backyard. And so that's what we set out to build.
And that's what you've built. And I assume that what's difficult is you're not the only one in the space. You know,
Etsy. Not anymore.
Etsy is certainly in the space. Even Amazon is in the space. Even
two small companies that maybe some people have heard of.
Small company. They're not going to go anywhere. And Zingerman's, you know, which started as a deli, which then became a catalog, also celebrating the same values.
Absolutely. In fact, from our first deck, Zingerman's was sort of the, you know, that was our inspiration.
We should tell people Zingerman's is this amazing company, started as a deli in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Now they have a creamery and they have a coffee roasting thing and a restaurant.
They have a bar,
and
a restaurant, a bakery, a candy machine, a candy manufacturing facility.
So Zingerman's loomed large in your decks.
They did, but they were sort of like, we want to do Zingerman's, but we want to do it slightly differently, right? So we are not about importing from Europe. We're not about... there's nothing wrong with what they've done. It's incredible, and it's one of the best food companies on the planet. We just wanted a slightly different take on it. So we said, let's do that. We'll do the punk rock version. We'll do the indie version of what they're doing. But absolutely.
Yeah.
So you're right. Not only are we're not the only ones doing it. We were one of the only people doing it early on, but other websites have caught up. Big giant companies have caught up. And even the traditional grocery stores have caught up.
Yeah,
these products were an anomaly on the shelf at Whole Foods, you know, 5 years ago. Now they carry the same products as we do in a lot of cases.
Which is in some ways gratifying to you, but also you must feel like they're appropriating some of your ideas.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, the other analogy that we used to talk about was for New Yorkers of a certain era, they'll remember that when Tower Records was open in the West Village, there was this tiny little indie record store across the street called Other Music.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, I remember
which,
that.
Which, you know, sold all the stuff that you couldn't get at Tower Records.
Right.
And they outlasted Tower Records. So we always held on. We thought, yeah, let the big guys try to do it. We'll outlast them. Listen, part of our job is to find talent. So I look at it as...
Yeah, you're food A&R guys.
We're out there looking for the next great pickle, the next great peanut butter, the next great bourbon. When we do and we see those people move up to Whole Foods or Target or Amazon, we're incredibly thrilled for them.
Right.
We're really happy for them. It's it does become a challenge for us just from running a business. You know, the competition is something
right.
that
but
can
then
hurt
it,
us.
It just means that you have to redouble your efforts to find the next great peanut butter or jam.
No, there's new stuff coming all the time.
Yeah.
And you're right. We started this company for two reasons. We started the company to help customers get access to all these great products. But we also started to help the entrepreneurs, to
yeah.
help these independent makers grow their business. And that's what we're doing. We are doing the things that they can't do. We have makers who are great at making beef jerky, great at making jam, great at making bourbon, not so good at putting that in a box and getting it to a customer.
Right.
Not so good at building a website
right.
and taking orders. So for us, by buying their product and exposing it to the world, we're helping build their businesses. And
yeah.
that's what we're trying to do. So
yeah,
we're actually happy when they move up.
Yeah. So, you know, I have to tell you, I don't know if I've told you at that breakfast we had with Maxwell, I have harbored dreams of doing what you have done.
Don't do it.
For years. But I always worried about three things. And so I wanted to ask you about the three things. And these were the three things that always stopped me.
Okay.
So one was the cost of holding goods in inventory. Two is the shipping and logistical issues. And then three, when it comes to mail order food, is the seasonal nature of the business. Like, how do you cope with all three of those things that I know these are things that you think about every day?
It's like medication, meditation. Coping mechanisms are necessary for entrepreneurs. No, you've identified some of the most difficult challenges that we have. You know, inventory, if you're good, I mean, look, every physical store deals with inventory problems. So we just have to be really good at planning. We have to know our customer. We have to know what we can take risks on and what we can't. And there's times when we're totally wrong. You know, we have launched entire categories of products. And there's a good – look, it's a learning moment. We tried to launch a big coffee department. We thought, you know, people who are really into their food are really into their coffee. Coffee is having this moment, this sort of coffee third generation, fourth generation of coffee. And so we went out and we studied coffee. We tasted hundreds, if not thousands, of different coffees, started to figure out what we wanted to carry. We brought in a bunch of coffee. We made a big deal. We launched it, and nobody came in to buy it.
Right.
We now know why. And I won't bore you with the details, but mostly because if you really love coffee, you have your coffee supplier. And
right.
you don't need to go buy it online and wait for it to show up 1 to 7 days later. So we blew it. But you know what? We didn't spend a ton of money building inventory. We're working with small producers. We're buying small quantities at a time. We're keeping in the warehouse. We've been we've either been very smart or very lucky or somewhere between the two to have a somewhat good sense of what people want to buy. That's not to say we don't make mistakes all the time, but we try as hard as we can to do this. And we have, you know, some of what we're able to do with the business because we're a gift business as well. So, you know, a good chunk of our business is people coming to mouth.com and buying stuff that they want to eat.
Right.
I want to try that new peanut butter, or I love that peanut butter. I can only get it there. We also send a lot of gifts. We wrap everything very carefully. We have a very, very rich and robust unboxing experience. So we try to make opening up a box from mouth like opening up an Apple product.
Right.
Layers of, hopefully not too wasteful, but layers of paper and bags mm-hmm. and things that open up and really feel like Christmas morning every time you open these boxes. And so in the gift side of things, it's even more interesting because what people will buy for themselves is different than what they will buy for
Absolutely.
Others. But there's a little bit more flexibility in gifting too, right? Because if I know you, I say, hey, I'm going to send 4 jars of pickles to my friend Ed. I don't necessarily want to go down to the level and pick them. And so they will talk to our gift concierge and say, hey, you know, I need 4 pickles. So, you know, we can do things like restaurants do where we can have specials.
Right.
And we can move inventory that way. So we have a warehouse here. I definitely walk through it every day. We're always on top of inventory. It's a real challenge. I guess the other one was shipping, you said?
Yeah.
Shipping is one of the largest challenges for
us. Yeah, because it changes your value proposition by definition.
Look, you can go into a local store and grab a $6 candy bar and walk out, and you've spent $6 and get to try that candy bar. You come to Mouth.com and you want a $6 candy bar, it's going to cost you another $12 before you can get it. And by the way, you have to wait somewhere from a day to a week.
Right.
And so when the shipping costs twice as much as the one thing you want to try, that's a problem. Now, look, a lot of people don't just walk into a store and buy one thing. So a lot of times people are buying three, four things. But you're right. One of the largest complaints, if not the largest complaint that we get, is your shipping is too expensive. And by the way, I can either say thank you or fuck you, Amazon, for creating an expectation that
it's absolutely
true. It's free and you can get it tomorrow.
And right. That's just, it's very hard to compete with free and you can get it tomorrow.
If you're that big and, you know, you can do that. We can't.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're selling expensive products to begin with. You know, the thing about indie food, about these small companies, is they tend to be using better ingredients than the big companies. They're making a lot of the stuff by hand. The production value is high, but the cost is high. And so we're already starting with a somewhat luxury, expensive product, tacking on shipping. It's a huge challenge for us.
Yeah. Wow. So you now have a retail presence. Is it mostly as you sell spirits and you open the warehouse, the food warehouse, right?
Well, so we're predominantly online.
Right.
So in the summer every year we have a warehouse sale where we you know, people in the neighborhood can come in and buy things, and helps a little bit with the inventory management. But we do operate a small liquor store in Brooklyn right around the corner from the warehouse and our offices. And it's been a way for us to, first of all, see what our brand does in the real world. Mm-hmm. How do we take the website?
Sure.
Because eventually, we probably want to open a bunch of stores.
Right, right.
To solve some of these problems you're just talking about.
Right.
But also to bring the brand to other people. You know, it's hard to build a retail brand. It's hard to build a small brand online. As you know, getting people to know about your website is an expensive, time-consuming, challenging prospect.
Yeah.
So we opened a liquor store, and what we love about it is that we're on the street and we're part of the neighborhood and we're meeting the people that live in the neighborhood. We're talking to our customers directly and getting real feedback
right.
in real time about
right.
what's working and what's
it's
not.
It's like a 7-day-a-week focus group.
Absolutely. We've learned so much just from the small store that has helped our business that, you know, we want to do more of that.
Yeah, that's cool. So, like, what are some of your latest discoveries that you're excited about? Of course, I did email you at 11 o'clock last night. It was like, hey, Craig, can you bring in stuff you're excited about?
I did. So I'll bring, I can't show, we can't show the listeners.
I know.
And look, there are so many things. We just got back from the fancy food show in San Francisco and saw a bunch of things there. And across the board, you know, you said this earlier, there's no shortage of innovation going on in the world. I mean, we saw this a company here in New York, and this is sort of the most obscure thing. There's a company here in New York, and they make shallot-infused oil and shallot-infused vinegar, and they're incredible, amazing products. They're coming out with a single-serve, pour-over Vietnamese coffee. So you have this beautiful little packet, like a tea bag that you put over a cup, you pour hot water on it, and then there's a packet of the condensed milk and spices, and
wow.
you mix it together.
That's
and
insane.
So it's like, you know, and it comes in a single serve packet,
yeah, yeah.
and it's great. It's,
yeah.
it's amazing. We saw a lot of chewable coffee. I mean, this is coffee in other forms is becoming a big thing this year. You know, so there's all sorts of fascinating things. But I brought, here's another example. This is a chili poblano liqueur.
A chili poblano liqueur, so
it's called
this beautiful green bottle with this really cool sort of nuevo retro label, and it's beautiful packaging, and I'm sure it's delicious.
It's delicious. It's made in Puebla, where, you know, restaurant people will tell you some of the, you know,
yes.
best restaurant
where
cooks
mole
in the world.
Was introduced.
And so they have two varieties of this, and we just started carrying it in the liquor store, and it's flying off the shelves. It adds a kick to any cocktail. It's delicious, but you're right. The bottle is beautiful.
Yeah.
The product is beautiful. It's made with really great ingredients.
Yeah.
We made drinks with it last night.
Right.
You know, so there's a bunch of different things, And we're always, I mean, just to give you an idea of some of the other things that we sell, these are not necessarily new. So this is a grenadine infused with rose hips from Brooklyn.
Wow.
So this is a good example of what I was talking about earlier. These are craftspeople who are taking something that has been made the same way for a long time, usually with crap in it, and have decided to make a better version of an item that people
right.
use frequently.
You know, there's a realness to the packaging and you know, there's a woman on the on this
it's all hand drawn.
Yeah, and it's hand drawn, and it's all part of the indie aesthetic, which is obvious a part of your brand.
It is. And, you know, and on the other hand, well, even this is a hand-drawn label. This is a company that's been around for a long time out of Texas called Cherith Gardens. And this is one that I forced on our team. I always loved pickled baby corn. So I found somebody
You're
who
made one of the few people in the world who loves pickled baby
well,
corn?
Well, so you asked about inventory. Turns out I am one of the few people in the world who like pickled baby corn. So so we have a couple of extra jars of that.
Got it.
Which have somehow made their way to my house. But that's a good example. And, you know, the thing that I'm really excited about more than sort of anything else this year is that we did our own products for the first time.
Right.
So we
came
out
a page out of the Zingerman's book.
We came out with three candy bars, and this is one of them. This is the one that has been the most popular. So it's called the High Five. My family really likes this candy bar called the Take Five. And yet it's a big commercial product made by one of those big companies. And the ingredients are, you know,
yeah.
They're okay, but they're not great. And it's too sweet for our taste. It's just too much. And so we decided what would happen if we made a real craft version of this.
So you worked with a local chocolatier.
We worked with a local producer, a local maker to help us with this. And not only were we super excited because we did it and it's delicious and we love it, but for me, the process of being a maker, it showed me again, it was like being back in the restaurant again. It was like, oh my God, this is so fucking
hard.
Yeah,
that's so interesting.
And you think, oh, you know, you make a candy bar. How hard can it be? But, you know, we got back the first batch and there was too much salt. So you say, okay, now make a new batch. And you
right.
wait 2 days.
Right.
And the next batch comes in. Oh, you know, I think that there's too much peanut butter, not enough caramel.
So this is called a High Five. It's got peanuts, caramel, peanut butter, pretzels, and milk chocolate.
Those are the five.
Very simple packaging, brown label, brown bag, and I might have to just try some.
You going to open it up? So you can open it up.
Yeah, well, Craig is really good. He brought a knife for me to
you work in the food business. You got to travel with hardware.
That's great. Oh, I love candy
so
bars.
So we... This just the recipe and production time alone, it probably took us 4 to 6 months to perfect that and, you know, of course, perfect to get it ready for release. I still probably have tweaks that I want to make to the next version of it.
It's delicious.
Well, thank you.
Have you thought about a dark chocolate version?
We're, you know, that's in the works.
All right. Dark,
it's, you know, it's funny. We're at Muff. We tend to like milk chocolate more than dark chocolate.
That's, which makes you something of an anomaly in the food world.
Absolutely. But, you know, and a lot of it, I'm pretty vocal about. I like my chocolate to be more luscious and creamy and rich than dark chocolate. And believe me, I like bitter things. I'm a bitter person in many ways. You know, I like bitter cocktails. I brought bitters. I brought an Amaro made in Brooklyn.
That's great.
You know, and so, but for some reason, I like milk chocolate more than dark chocolate.
That's
so
right.
We lean that
way. We'll let you live.
All right.
Now it's time for the special sauce buffet. It's a series of questions we ask everybody, and we're always amazed by the diversity of the answers. It's really a fun thing for us. So, who's at your last supper? No family allowed. You get four places at your table.
I get four places. You know, I'm gonna be influenced by what's been in my zeitgeist the last couple weeks. So I'm gonna say Mario Batali.
Okay, a fine start.
Fine start. He's gonna be good with the food and good with the talk. I'm gonna throw David Bowie in there. Barack Obama.
Barack Obama.
I would put Barack Obama at that table. I especially now, mm-hmm. right in this environment, I would love to hear candidly what he really thinks, but also the what he went through,
mm-hmm.
you know.
The struggles.
The struggles, but I think also people really underestimate in a lot of ways what it takes to do that job.
I couldn't agree more.
I mean, I met Bill Clinton once, and he knows his shit. He knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and anything.
Yeah.
On any question. I can't imagine our current situation.
Barack Obama, David Bowie,
Mario Batali.
This is a very cool table. You have to fill it out with one more person.
I absolutely do. I could even have Michelle Obama in there, but I don't want them both at the same time. So I could swap out Barack for Michelle.
Okay.
And I'd be totally fine with either one of them.
Okay.
So I would say
Obama.
Right.
Okay.
I don't know if it's Michelle or Barack, but one of the two of them
would
keep that party going without a problem.
All right.
And Frida Kahlo.
Frida Kahlo.
So Frida Kahlo, I think I would put in, you know, I think a female painter would be.
Frida Kahlo's awesome.
My
Frida Kahlo
like,
or George O'Keefe, maybe. George O'Keefe would be cool. But Frida Kahlo, Michelle Obama, David Bowie, and Mario Batali.
It's a good dinner party, right?
It's a great damn dinner party. So what are you eating?
Well, if it's my last supper, then I'm going for my comfort foods, right?
Okay.
So things that I think about associating with comfort. And so a stuffed breast of veal.
Okay.
Stuff with a garlicky mashed potatoes thing. I mean, look, I would probably start with some incredible cheese course and some salmon roe, some ikura.
All right. So,
you know, we're gonna go all over the culinary map.
Yeah.
And
dessert?
And dessert is gonna be the dessert that my mom made for me when I was a kid on my birthday every year, which is a chocolate cream pie with a meringue crust.
Wow. Which is very popular all over the South.
Yeah, and it was not a Minneapolis recipe.
That's funny.
So it was not a Midwest thing. And I don't know why. It was way ahead of a gluten-free era. It was not, for no reason, I don't know why. Maybe it was a Passover recipe that ended up becoming like a main thing. But those would be sort of, some of the comforting things. Look, on the other end, I probably have some Ample Hills ice cream next to it. Because,
yeah, because it's awesome.
Or some Oddfellows, really.
So you have two children.
Yes, I do.
And a wife.
Yep.
What do you cook when you come home and there's not much in the house to eat and you haven't done any shopping on the way home?
Well, you know,
like what's your go-to if that's the case?
If we just have to make stuff in the house, a lot of times it'll be a pasta with something. You know, being in the food business, we always have a full pantry. You know, the interesting thing about Mouth is that we talk about this. We sell a lot of stuff around the edge of the plate, but we don't really sell stuff in the middle of the plate.
Right.
So we got a lot of toppings and condiments and sides.
Right. But mine's pasta, by the way, with Rao's marinara sauce.
So we have this sauce that we stockpile from a tiny little place up in Montreal, in Mile End, that this storefront is 50 square. It's like the size of the sound booth. It's tiny. You can't have four people cannot fit in this
really?
At the same time. And all they do is make sauce all day long. And they have three varieties of sauce. So ideally, we would open up a jar of this sauce from Montreal and pour it over some pasta.
And what kinds of sauces?
It's a marinara. It's a tomato sauce.
Got it.
They have a spicy one and a regular one. And it's a traditional old school red sauce.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. It comes in your ball jar.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Yeah. Sometimes I use Mario sauces, which have also gotten really good.
They are.
This is a tough question for you. What's your guilty pleasure, or just give me two or three guilty pleasures? Since you're every day you're surrounded by guilty pleasures.
I was going to say they are chocolate babka from Bread's Bakery.
That is one of the great answers because I just, you know, I told you that my brother just passed away, and I brought up babka to my sister-in-law. Really didn't sit Shiva, but we had a small gathering after the graveside service, and I brought up three chocolate babkas from Brett's Bakery.
It's
so, you know, that you go a long way with that answer.
Yeah, I know, it's ridiculous. So can I leave it at that?
Yeah, you
okay,
can just
good.
Leave it at that. All right, so who is the one person, and I'm genuinely interested in your answer, given all the things that you've done, that you would love to break bread with, have lunch with, and just hear how they think about the world and explain what they do?
You know, on one hand, I'm fascinated by successful entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, a gut reaction answer is somebody like Richard Branson.
Mm-hmm.
But then my other inner voice says, come on, he's had so much success. What you really want to talk to is someone who's been battered and battered and battered,
mm-hmm.
Who's going to inspire you to keep going. And I probably don't know who that person is because they've been battered so much.
Yes.
So, you know, I Branson is a fascinating guy, and he's,
sure.
Look, you know, it's like Elon Musk, right? I mean, these people who have taken on challenges in space travel and music and entertainment.
Yes,
and
in multiple ways.
In totally different industries and have really set the world on fire and inspire people. Those people are inspiring to me. I don't know if they're assholes in real life, so, you know, I might
right.
regret that choice.
Sure.
But let's stick with Branson for now.
Okay.
I think that was the first thing that popped
yeah,
into
yeah.
my head.
So it's just been declared Craig Kanarek Day.
Oh, God, I'm sorry.
What's happening all over the world on that day?
I guess people are eating good food and enjoying themselves. It sounds very hokey, and all of us, you, me, most entrepreneurs, most business owners are trying to help other people. They're just trying to make other people a little bit happier. You don't want to do your fucking laundry? I'll do it for you. You don't want to cook? I'll cook for you. You need something to read? You need something to entertain you? I'll do that for you. We're in the happiness business. And it's very cliche, but we're all,
mm-hmm.
all of us that are making things, yeah, we're doing it for ourselves. No doubt, right? We're trying to send our
yeah.
kids to school, pay our rent, do all that. That, you know, the main reason I'm trying to sell these products is because when I open them up and I eat them, I'm happy. I find it to be great. And when I have a dinner party and I'm able to pull out this chocolate bar and tell the story of how I made it, or pull out somebody else's chocolate bar and tell about the guy who used to be the, you know, the Kevlar vest expert who then, you know, sold his business and got in the chocolate business, and you got to try this and it's amazing and it's made with this spice from here and here and here. I know the reaction that other people get when they're like, oh my God, this is great. I got to get some of this.
Yeah.
So I just hope people are eating and having a good time.
Surrounded by the people they love.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. Thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Craig Kanarek. Go to mouth.com to get some mighty tasty vittles delivered to your door and some mighty tasty spirits as well. And if you find yourself in Brooklyn, check out the Mouth store. And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters. And thank you so much, Craig, for being with us.
Thank you, Ed. It was a real pleasure.